Our next guest on Club Respect Global Resistance is a senior lecturer in sport management at Portsmouth University. He's a published author, leading academic, and frontline social media warrior against the abuse of match officials. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Tom Webb.
No worries. Thanks very much for the invitation.
And how did you arrive at this issue as one of your life missions?
Well, I guess I've been researching and working with sports officials for a number of years now, probably nearly 20 years, not far off. And over that period of time, we've sort of dipped into the abuse of officials a number of years ago. So as part of my master's dissertation, we looked at the training and development of referees in football. And this was back in 2004, 2005. And one of the things that struck us from that research was the issues and the challenges that they face. And one of those challenges was the amount of abuse that they encountered within their role. And so over time, we then looked at it again. The Respect Programme came into English football in 2008, and we looked at the impact of that programme. We looked at whether it had been successful at different levels of the sport and what the perception of that programme was. And we found, I think it's fair to say, a mixed reaction. At youth football, I think people were slightly more enamoured with what had happened with the programme, as the programme was initiated in adult football, it wasn't as well received. But we were still seeing this level of abuse, and it wasn't declining. And, you know, because I'd worked with officials across sports for a number of years and researched into this body of people, if you like, I was seeing and party to a number of accounts and recollections of the severity of abuse and physical abuse and things like that. And, you know, it just struck me that why is this acceptable? You know, why is it acceptable for these people to go about their job, their role, their essential role within sport, and for this to be happening to them? And why is that okay? And it shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be just an accepted part of any sport. So it sort of came from there. And, you know, the research sort of gave me a first-hand view, if you like, into what's going on and sort of the challenges that people are facing across sports and around the world as well.
So you're one of the leading academics worldwide in providing an evidence base on this phenomena of abuse. It's a form of self-sabotage, because if there's less referees in the funnel, the lower the quality of the referees. So what is it in the human psyche that can't control the abuse of people who are providing an essential service?
Yeah, well, firstly, I think you're absolutely right. So sports officials are an essential part of the fabric of the majority of sports. We need sports officials for competitive sport to take place. If they're not there, then the integrity of the game is called into question. As to why it happens, I think you can look at different sports to see how the abuse of officials has sort of charted. And if you look at football as an example, soccer in England, it's not a new thing. It's been around for, you know, a considerable period of time. Even pre-codification in 1863, there were accounts of referees being abused by gamblers who were blaming them for losing money on fixtures and things like that. So it's not a new thing. But that, to my mind, that makes it worse in a way, because what that means is we haven't dealt with it effectively. We're still seeing the problems today. We're still seeing, you know, high profile incidents of abuse and issues related to that. And it means that whatever has happened previously in terms of intervention, in terms of policy, hasn't addressed the problem as well as it could. And if we look at other sports, you know, we published a book a couple of years ago on abuse, and we looked at it from a global perspective towards officials. We looked at, you know, football within Europe. There were problems there. We looked at cricket. We looked at rugby union. There were growing issues in those sports. Cricket, for example, has had to introduce red cards a few years ago just because the incidents of abuse were escalating and the umpires didn't have enough of a deterrent or a tool to deal with players on the field of play that were transgressing the rules. And so, you know, football, soccer is the easy one to look at because, it, you know, there's a lot of high-profile incidents and issues. But other sports have got problems as well, and they're growing in those sports. And I think that's a real concern and means it's a wider societal problem that we need to address because, you know, why is it acceptable that this abuse exists towards sports officials is the question we need to answer. And you're absolutely right. People will start walking away, and they are walking away from sports officiating if it continues.
So the shortages of match officials across the world, I think it's fair to say it's a full-blown crisis. There's referee strikes in Germany and Spain. In the English Premier League, referees are told not to have social media accounts. I looked at your social media accounts filled with videos and pictures of violence against referees. It's so important, yet it's such a low priority. I mean, I don't understand why it's so hard to get crisis-level urgency on this issue. It blows my mind.
Yeah, I completely agree. So, you know, we have to separate the sort of elite game from the mass participation game, I guess, when we're talking about football, that, you know, we're moving towards two almost different forms of football or soccer there. You know, we're talking about the elite game, which has VAR, which has goal line technology, which may well have automated offside, which is coming into the, you know, but it sounds as though it's going to be part of the World Cup in Qatar. You know, we're looking at all these things and we're moving further and further away from the sports, you know, from the game being, you know, the same, if you like. You obviously don't have the majority of levels, those interventions, those technological developments available to officials, players and coaches. It's, you know, it doesn't exist. So we're sort of almost in the separation of the game, if you like. And at the elite level, yes, abuse exists. It's the difference within the abuse is the scale, is the media presence, you know, if you like. So if a player behaves badly to an official in the Premier League, for example, millions, billions of people see that around the world. And that then means that people see that behaviour and think that it's acceptable, that it's okay to do that. And that's a real challenge because, you know, as professional football has become more akin to sort of the media relationships and the exposure on television, more people see the games, more people see how players behave, more people know the referees as well. And so that leads on to why they don't have social media accounts, because if they did, you know, we would probably see far more social media abuse than we already do towards those officials. And, you know, in the Premier League, they are told explicitly not to have social media accounts. And so we still see that behaviour. It still transgresses social media, even if they don't have those accounts. It sort of goes beyond that, if you like. For example, Mike Dean last season in the Premier League was subjected to severe online abuse. He hasn't got a social media account, but then people found ways to access his family and things like that. And a couple of seasons before, it was Michael Oliver from the Premier League when he officiated a Champions League game, and people managed to find out where he lived, where his wife worked, you know, things like that. So there are ways for these people to find a way to access even the most high profile officials, even if they don't have social media accounts. And so what we have to do is think about why this behavior is so ingrained in the game. Why, you know, and growing in other sports, why is it acceptable? Why is it seen as something that's part of the game, if you like? Because it shouldn't be. No one should be subjected to that sort of abuse when they go to work in their workplace. These guys are professional referees who officiate at the highest level in the Premier League and other comparable professional leagues around the world. They are in a workplace setting. You know, we've got a duty of care to look after these people when they are in those settings. And so, you know, we need to consider how we deal with this issue.
Could one of the issues be the fact that fans follow media broadcasters, pundits, commentators, and they role model the way they treat referees, and they've got the benefits of replays and hindsight. And what role does that media scrutiny have in referees being respected or disrespected? And what can we do to change that? It's like the media are kind of beyond the reach of the FA and the various organizations, but I see them being absolutely crucial in referees being disrespected, derided at times.
Yeah, they certainly have a significant role to play. And I think sometimes they don't necessarily think about the consequence of the coverage or how they might, or how some of the pundits might speak about the officiating. It's very easy to say, you know, oh, it's not very good. Well, okay, but certainly within the work we do and the research we've done over a significant period of time, what we want to look at is, okay, well, if that's a problem, why is it a problem? Okay, if we think that there's a problem at the top level, what is happening in the development pathway? Where is the talent ID taking place? Where is the talent development? What is the coaching like for referees? Where does that coaching take place? Who is providing it? What is the structure around these officials like? Is it best fit? Is it best value to get the best out of that workforce? Because the easy way out is just to say at the top level, well, they're not good enough. Well, okay, but that person has gone through a system to be at that point, officiating that fixture at that time on that television platform. So we need to, you know, think about it in much more detail, much more depth than that. And the argument is far more nuanced than that sort of either they're good or they're not approach. And so I don't think sometimes pundits, media platforms think about what impact their words, their opinions might have. I know they're paid to have an opinion. I completely understand that. But we have to think about the sort of good of the game as well. Now, some platforms have, in the last 2-3 years, started having referees. If we're talking about soccer, football, they've had them on the program, and they have them that it cuts away to these ex-referees more often than not, who then give the officiating perspective on why a decision was given. That's a step in the right direction, but more often than not, pundits might disagree. And, you know, do they fully understand the laws of the game, for example? That might be a problem.
Yes.
And, of course, many of the decisions we give in football or soccer are subjective. You know, so yes, there are some laws which are yes and no. You know, it's why goal line technology works particularly well, because if the technology is good enough to measure whether a ball is over the line or not over the line, that is a yes no question. Yeah, it's a simple binary choice, if you like.
Yep.
But the majority of the decisions that referees make during the course of a football match are not yes, no answers. They are subjective and they are open to interpretation. The laws of the game are there to be interpreted. So I think that's where many of the problems come in. And I think a lack of understanding of that simple sort of fact is a problem. But also the fact that, you know, look, if you listen to many of the sort of pundits and things like that, some of them are really good and some of them are very balanced. Some, you know, clearly don't understand the laws of the game or haven't researched before they've made a comment. Now, that can have detrimental effects on, you know, the refereeing workforce, the guys at the top level, and of course that can filter down to people at lower levels as well.
I find coaches often get off lightly as a cause of the breakdown of the culture of respect for referees. And if a coach abuses an official, gives permission for the players to do the same. And coaches are often seen as the gods at clubs from grassroots level to elite level. And how do you see the current levels of coach abuse of officials reducing? Because if they do it, it kind of gives everyone permission to do it.
Yeah, it's the same principle as players, isn't it? If there's a precedent, you know, at the side of the pitch in a coach or manager role, that someone's behaving in a certain way, you know, people see that as acceptable. And I think you only have to look at junior football, youth football around the globe, really, to see that coaches are part of the problem, players are part of the problem, and spectators are part of the problem. when we're talking about this abuse. You know, there's different stakeholder groups involved in sport, one of which is players, one of which is coaches, managers, another is spectators, and the other group is officials, referees, umpires. They're all part of that fabric of sport, if you like. And we have to find a way of them better coexisting than happens at the moment. You know, so can we look at, for example, we're talking about coaches, can we include more about the role of the official in coaching awards? Well, I don't see why we can't do that. At the moment, I've taken coaching awards. I coach my son's football team. There's very little about the role of the referee within that. You know, there's certainly not very much about, quite often in youth football, the fact that the referee you might have for your game is a young person who's under the age of 18. And there are safeguarding and well-being issues associated to that. That's not covered enough. You know, what about all the preparation and administration that referees do, the training they do before they get to the point where they're standing in front of you on a match day, talking to you about, you know, boot checks and stud checks and how they want the game to go, and then talking to your players about what they're going to expect of them during the game. What happens before that part of the process and also afterwards? You know, I don't think there's enough understanding about the role of officials generally in sport. And I think that could be something that's brought into coaching awards to really help with that understanding. If we're talking about at the highest level, then absolutely, you know, people's behaviour has consequences. And that's players and coaches as well as officials, you know, they're high profile figures. And so every performance, every interaction, if it's on camera, is going to have some sort of consequence, you know, and if it's a negative interaction, it might well be that that's something that's focused upon in post-match analysis and things like that. And I think too often we seek to excuse behaviour and comments about officiating. You know, when do managers do that about the opposition players or even their own players if they make a mistake or their performance is not as good as they would like? Well, of course, referees will make mistakes. Of course, sports officials will make errors, but so do players and so do coaches. That's part of sport. And I think we seem to have moved towards this almost this dichotomy where it's acceptable for players and coaches and managers to make errors during the course of a game, but it's not acceptable for officials. Why is that? You know, because the reality is that either what happens in a game, or if we're talking about football, is either an amazing piece of skill which leads to a goal, or generally some sort of error has occurred and a goal's been scored as a result or missed as a result. That happens every single match, and coaches get tactics wrong. They get formations wrong. They might select the wrong player. You know, that happens, but it seems to be acceptable. And yet when a referee makes what's deemed to be an error, you know, it's not acceptable. Well, you know, people make mistakes. It happens. Referees are actually exceptionally good at making decisions and making good decisions as well. If you look at the accuracy of decision making in football at the top level, it's exceptionally high. So, you know, I think going back to your point, we sort of need to reset the relationships between the stakeholders in sport. When I'm talking about officials, coaches, players, spectators, we need to think about those relationships and those interactions a lot more.
I agree. I think the fundamental is if you are being abused, you can't be at your best because you're worried about other things and perceptions that are coming at you. There's an old saying, sunshine's the best disinfectant. What are your thoughts on getting body cameras onto referees just to reduce the verbal abuse and actual assaults? Just the fact that you won't have to drag the referee through a tribunal where it's he said and you go back and forth, you've actually got some hard evidence. Is it too far?
Well, I saw the outcome of the IFAB meeting yesterday where it was agreed or raised in principle that there might be some sort of trial, which I think, you know, has probably been a long time coming. I don't see why we can't trial it. I do think there are still significant legal and ethical issues that need to be considered. You know, for example, we're talking about tribunals within football there. Fine. Okay, I can see how that would be really useful because it would get rid of the he said, she said, they said, you know, argument. It would be more factual. But then, you know, if there's a serious physical assault, can that footage be used to prosecute someone? Do people have to give their consent? And does it have to be done on each individual basis? Or does it have to be done on a team basis or a league basis or a county FA basis or a national FA basis? How would that work? We've got to think about GDPR. So how would the footage be used? You know, how anonymity be assured if that footage, you know, is just being used for, you know, within the game for tribunal purposes, or, you know, it could be used for training purposes for referees. But then do we then have to get consent and assent from all the participants again? What about the people that are watching on the side of the pitch? They might be in shot at some point. You know, have they given consent? So I think on the basis of it, I can see, absolutely see potential benefits of having that ability to record incidents and things like that. And I can see it would be a deterrent. But even within the police, when they started using body cams, there were issues that they had to work out. And so I don't think it would be something that would happen instantly and would instantly necessarily reduce abuse. I think we would have to trial it really carefully. We'd have to measure that, you know, how it's used, how it's implemented, and probably trial it in a number of different ways. How it's used, does the referee push the record button? Is it always recording? Again, the ethical issues come into play there. So I think I can see the benefit, absolutely, and I'm all for any other deterrent, you know, that might reduce abuse towards officials. If it will, then I would absolutely be supportive. I think we need to be careful about how it's introduced and how we use it. And I think that's something which probably the lawmakers have been wary about up to now. And I think the trials would be really important in terms of how it's implemented and how it's used. And also the protocols around the use of body cams and the video footage, that would be really important as well, I think.
Excellent. I agree with you. I think they have to try it now. And I think even like CCTV camera, at least it acts as some sort of deterrent where people, it will give some people some pause that their actions may be captured. But as usual, these things get wrapped up in legal. Really interested in cultural differences. You've done a deep dive on referee experiences in France and the Netherlands and England and La Liga. They all look like close neighbours to us in Australia, but what sort of cultural differences did you come across in referee experiences?
Yeah, so interesting. I mean, Europe's quite an interesting one because although the countries are geographically quite close, I mean, if we're talking about Australia, obviously it's a massive country and you know, Australasia, Oceania is huge, covers a huge geographical area. When we're talking about Europe, it's relatively close together. So yeah, absolutely, I take your point. But within that, there are quite significant differences in terms of the culture. So if you look at Latin Europe, for example, and we're talking about Italy, Spain, Portugal, those sorts of countries, compared to somewhere that's more anglicised like the UK or somewhere like Scandinavia, which again has slightly different values and things, what we see is quite significant differences in terms of what's acceptable. So when we're talking about the laws of the game and the interpretation of the laws of the game, what's acceptable in terms of player behaviour? So if you look at those countries, which I talked about, Latin countries, Latin Europe, you know, it's far more acceptable to simulate, if you like, to dive. In Italy and Spain, it's considered, particularly in Italy, part of the game, you know, that players will do it. And in fact, it's the referee's fault if they don't detect it. It's not the player's fault for doing it. Whereas if you look in the UK and England in the Premier League, it's something that's frowned upon. You don't see it very often. And we don't have that ethos built into football in England. It's not part of the game, if you like. which is why when you see players come to England from some of those countries, it is a bit of a culture shock because, you know, it might be acceptable in a Portuguese league and a Spanish league, and it might be part of the game, but in England, it's not. And it's not something which is considered acceptable. So even with player behaviour and therefore how you officiate, that changes. There are differences in terms of the training and the development. Every system is slightly different, even in Europe. The systems aren't the same. The development pathways aren't the same. And so what happens in one country might not be the same as what happens in another country. There are differences at the top level in terms of promotion and relegation of even the elite officials. There are differences in terms of the fitness tests they do, in terms of the technical development and testing that they do as well. So the work we did, and you mentioned a few of the countries there, there's significant differences. And we can look at abuse as well. And there's differences in terms of how that abuse manifests itself, but also in terms of the levels of abuse that people and officials in football are subjected to. So in the Netherlands, that abuse level is lower. It's still higher than 50% for verbal abuse, but it's not as high as we see in England, for example. But there are reasons for that. And one of the reasons for that is that, unfortunately, a number of years ago, about 7 or 8 years ago, there was a tragedy in Dutch football where an assistant referee was attacked and killed after a youth match by supporters of the opposite team. And that, quite understandably, has led to significant policy shifts and changes within the policy in the Netherlands. And so they've brought in a number of different policies which are focused on the abuse of officials. They've put in place more support networks around officials. And what they've seen is a reduction in abuse towards officials. It's still higher than other sports, but it's not as high as we see in other countries in terms of football. So there are reasons for the differences, but there are also similarities and trends which we can see across countries. And again, that might be in terms of the abuse levels and particularly verbal abuse, but also some of the training and development as well. There are crossovers there. But when you start digging down, you start to realise that there are some differences and they are reasonably significant when you go to different countries, even within Europe. And then, of course, if you go to somewhere like South America, you'll see, you know, changes and differences that are exacerbated even further. So some of that comes down to funding. Some of that comes down to the profile of the leagues and the, you know, the Premier League, for example, in England has got, you know, a significant profile, but also is the most successful football competition that there is in terms of exporting the television rights and the sponsorship and the income that it generates, which is why they can afford to invest, like they're doing this summer, over approximately £500,000 in elite officiating, you know, and bringing in more posts for those referees at the top level. They can do that because of the money that's in the game. It's not the same in some countries. So when we start digging below the surface a little bit, we start to see that these differences, you know, occur and also how they manifest themselves in performance as well.
I recently saw a new paper on mental health status of professional referees in Turkey. I found right across everything I've looked at across all the countries, mental health has been bubbling at the surface. It's still a bit of a taboo topic. So why isn't this abuse framed as an issue that provokes and triggers mental health issues in people?
Yeah, I mean, that's some of the work we've been doing more recently. We've been looking at the impact of abuse, you know, the fact that it's at such significant levels, if you like, both verbal and physical abuse, aggression towards officials, means that there will be some sort of associated consequence to individuals. Now, that differs from person to person. What I might find affects my mental health negatively, someone else might not. But the problem we've had up until now, really, is that we haven't really had this focus on sort of good mental health in officiating or what that might look like and what might affect the mental health of referees negatively as well. And abuse is clearly one of those problems which needs addressing. And I think it hasn't had enough attention. I mean, if you look at the literature that's out there, there's only a handful of studies on the mental health of sports officials, of which I think I've been involved in maybe 2 out of 4 or 5 of them, you know, and that's globally. So clearly we need to do a lot more work in terms of understanding the challenges and the barriers to good mental health, the triggers for what might impact referees and sports officials negatively, and also interventions. What can we do to really improve the mental health of sports officials? What's encouraging in an academic perspective is we've achieved some funding with researchers in the UK, but also in Canada as well, on a grant which is looking at this impact of mental health and mental health in sports officials over the next 3 years. And I think that will help our understanding, certainly. And we need more of that. We need to understand the barriers, the challenges, but also, you know, what is positive in terms of the mental health of sports officials? What impacts them positively? What do we need to focus on improving so that the mental health of referees and umpires is positively affected? It should be something that they look at positively in terms of officiating, that they do it because it has a positive impact. And so we know what some of the barriers are. We know what some of the challenges are. Let's look at some of the positive aspects and accentuate that. And I think that's something which really needs to be focused on and hasn't occurred. And you can look at the mental health of players and coaches. That's meant, you know, received far more attention and coverage, both in academic literature and in the focus of governing bodies as well. And we need to, again, we go back to the stakeholder groups in sport. Sports officials are part of that group, the stakeholder group, and they haven't had as much attention in terms of their mental health and good mental health. And that's certainly something which needs to change.
On a positive note, female referees, I see 3 female referees have been selected to officiate at the Men's World Cup. One from France, one from Rwanda, one from Japan. Is there any positivity for you there on the female side, or they're being impacted by this abuse equally?
Yeah, very positive. I think we've still got a long way to go. Certain countries are better than others. And again, that will come down to the funding, the money that's involved and things like that as well. And you know, the money the professional leagues generate. But there's absolutely no reason why female officials can't officiate in men's competitions and vice versa. I think, you know, in 2022, you know, we should be looking at that and thinking that absolutely that's possible and should be possible. So very encouraging that FIFA have selected those female officials. I'm part of an Erasmus Plus funded project, which is looking at female officiating across Europe. At the moment, it's a 3-year project. I'm leading the research phase of that project. So it's something that I'm very interested in and I think should be actively promoted within sports. It should be something that, you know, it should be inclusive. I don't think we should be looking at, oh, it's a men's sport, it's a female sport, this is a men's pathway, this is a female pathway. I think we're at a point where, you know, we need to think about this as a sort of inclusive pastime or profession, depending on the level you're at. And there's no reason why we can't, you know. And I think what's interesting, certainly in terms of the research, and we haven't got the final findings yet from the project, but that will happen in the next few months, in terms of the research. But certainly female officials are reporting that they think they're treated slightly differently to male officials. And that might be in terms of abuse. It might be in terms of, you know, how they feel treated within their sport. But if that's true, and if that's something which, you know, which comes through the analysis, which it looks like it is at the moment, that has significant knock-on effects in terms of abuse. You know, if abuse can be reduced by having female officials, and if male players in particular are less likely to abuse a female official, then we need to look at the placement of female officials and how they're used, and also look at how we're recruiting and retaining those female officials and trying to do more of it. Because if it can reduce abuse, that's something which we should be considering. You know, I think anything which can reduce abuse, aggression towards sports officials should be considered. So, yeah, the project around Europe, which I'm involved with, is called the WINS Project, and it's something which we're really hoping. We've got a number of different partners in different sports, from European Athletics to the Dutch Olympic Committee to various other partners. And we did a survey across Europe, which actually went a bit further than that. We managed to get representation of over 60 countries, had over 3,200 responses from female officials. So that will give us a far better understanding of the barriers, the challenges, but also some of the positive aspects of officiating from a female official perspective. And, you know, again, I think that can only help.
At grassroots level, I'm hearing some pretty horrifying numbers about referees. I mean, what role does verbal abuse have on impacting recruitment and retention of referees at grassroots level?
Yeah, so, I mean, what we're seeing across sports and across countries is that there is a significant issue with dropout. There's a lack of retention, and there's a number of reasons for that. It's not just abuse, although abuse is a significant contributory factor. But we're also seeing, you know, issues around the support networks, whether that's formal or informal. You talked about disciplinary processes earlier, tribunals. We see issues across sports with the disciplinary networks, with how they're set up, with how well they support referees in that process. Generally, it's felt that, you know, they could be supported better within those processes. But also the coaching development networks around officials, around referees. You know, are they fit for purpose in the modern world? You know, what's the structure of refereeing like? How are referees being recruited? Are they still being recruited from the same places, or do we need to think outside the box a little bit more? Do we need to think, well, you know, we're not getting enough numbers through the door, or we're not retaining enough of them? Do we need to think about where we're recruiting from? Do we need to go to different places, as well as the traditional schools, colleges, things like that, that, you know, which are sort of the staple of recruitment of young officials, referees, particularly in England? Do we need to think a little bit differently about that? And when we're talking about retaining them, you know, sport is not sustainable if we have the dropout rates that we've got at the moment. And, you know, that's true across sports. We need to retain more officials, because that also has a significant impact on the quality of the officiating right through the development pathway. So when we go back to people talking about, you know, officiating in the Premier League could be better in England and things like that, again, I go back to, well, okay, but what's the pathway? How many have you got coming through that pathway? What's the training and development of those officials like? Is it good enough? Is it fit for purpose? How are we identifying talent? Are we doing it at an early enough age? You know, can we look at the processes and procedures that we've got around the recruitment and retention of these officials? Are there better ways that we might be able to do it? You know, so I think we need to think about that. I think clearly recruitment and retention at the moment is a significant challenge, and COVID has also contributed to that. I think we need to understand that. We had a lot of unnatural breaks in seasons where, you know, we normally have one break a season, and that's where your recruitment and retention, you know, you hope there's a sort of equilibrium there with the number of officials that leave and the number you recruit. Clearly, if you have more off seasons, if you like, or enforced breaks, there's the possibility that more people will leave in those breaks. And also you can't recruit the numbers that you would normally recruit because of COVID enforced social distancing. You know, you can't deliver the practical aspect of the course because, you know, you can't have people in those sort of spaces. So, of course, that's had a knock-on effect as well. But the downward trajectory of retention was in place before COVID hit, before the pandemic became a problem. And that's just, you know, accentuated the issues, I think.
Now, you care so much about this issue that you've co-authored a book, Referees, Match Officials and Abuse, Research and Implications for Policy. Did you have any aha moments or any real eureka moments from writing that book on some silver bullet things we can do?
Yeah, well, what we focused on at the end of the book was a 10-point plan, if you like, which basically brought together all the research, all the work that we'd done across different sports, across different countries. And we really focused on bringing that together and looking at what we can do to change the situation. Because, you know, what really struck us when we were, you know, going through the data and doing the work in, you know, around the world really, was this shared trend. There's an increase of abuse, you know, and if we're talking about cricket, rugby union, we had media reports of issues within American sport, you know, 80% dropout rates in high school officials, reports of issues in rugby league in Australia, rugby union in New Zealand, of, you know, incidents where officials have been attacked or physically assaulted, or, you know, and we were seeing this, you know, wherever we looked really. And that was the shocking thing for us, that, you know, perhaps I don't think we anticipated the scale of the problem before we started really looking at the issues across sports and across countries. Certainly sports like cricket and rugby union, we didn't expect, you know, the data to tell us that there was such an issue. And that was really eye-opening. And so what we focused on in that final chapter is really, well, look, these are the problems, but let's look at what we can do. You know, let's look positively at some sports that are doing some good things, that are really trying to make a difference. And there are examples of good practice. If we look at hockey in Australia, for example, there's been Hockey New South Wales we looked at in the book, where they'd had pledges of positivity and codes of conduct and things like that that people were signing up to and teams had to adhere to. You know, there was some things from county FAs in England, some initiatives that were really good, such as, you know, young official campaigns and wearing different colour armbands depending on age and experience and things like that, which were instigated a few years ago. And so there were pockets of really innovative stuff and things that people were doing that, you know, were trying to make a difference. And so we tried to end the book on a bit more of a positive note, looking at some things that were working, but also understanding that sports need to talk to each other more, that there needs to be more interaction between and within sports, you know, but also outside of sports. Can we learn from other sports? What's been tried somewhere that's worked and hasn't worked? You know, so we don't need to reinvent the wheel. If it's worked somewhere, can we implement it and amend it to our sport? If it hasn't worked, why hasn't it worked? Let's learn the lessons from that, you know, rather than doing the same things over and over again in different countries and different sports and getting the same results. So hopefully that final chapter and the last couple of chapters really tried to focus on sort of positive aspects, but also, you know, what we learned over the, you know, the analysis of the data, but also the, you know, the work we've done around the world and in different sports, trying to bring some of this content together.
Fantastic. And final question, the silver bullet question: a wealthy philanthropist leaves you an enormous budget to fix this problem, to get respect back in for referees. Money's not an issue anymore. What would you invest in?
That's a really good question. So I think, no, there's so many things, but I think, you know, if money's no object, I'd be looking at things like, we've talked about the development pathways. I'd be doing firstly a thorough analysis of the development pathway. So I'd be looking at how people are recruited, how they're retained, how they're trained at different levels of the development pyramid, if you like, the pathway. I'd be looking at how we provide coaching, how we provide support, what the dropout rates were at certain points of that pathway. Are there pinch points? You know, if there are, why do they happen at those points? What are the barriers to progression? And even at, you know, at mass participation level, what can we put in place that supports people better? What can we do to help people enjoy the experience, to stay in the game longer? And of course, there will always be dropout. There'll always be, you know, we'll always want more retention of officials, of referees in football or umpires in cricket or whatever we're talking about. But, you know, how can we understand the challenges they face better and what can we do to improve that situation? I'd also look at, like I said, I'd look at the coaching awards. I'd look at what we could do to improve the knowledge of coaches, what we could do to increase the importance of the role of the referee or the awareness of the importance of their role and of sports officials more generally. And the biggest thing I would do is stop officials being the final group that gets any sort of investment, because that's what has happened historically. We look at football, it's always players and coaches that come first and then officials come later. Well, let's put them first. Let's change that. Let's, you know, if we're saying we want more officials and we want them, you know, trained to higher levels and all this sort of stuff, well, let's invest. Let's put that money there and let's do it, you know. So, I mean, if you had that sort of investment, I would be looking at that as a sort of a process, basically, and I'd look at every single level and what we could do to, A, improve that recruitment, improve that development process, and then at the top level, you would see those people coming through the system. You'd have more in that system. You should improve then quality at higher levels as well. You should be pushing those people at that top level. And I think that would make a difference. But it's, yeah, as you say, you know, if you had that investment, it would make a significant difference.
Indeed. Well, thank you. You're fighting the good fight. And where can we find Dr. Tom Webb?
Yeah, so I'm at the University of Portsmouth in the UK at the moment. I coordinate the Referee Match Official Research Network from there. And I say, like, you know, the majority of my research is around officiating. We've got a number of different publications in the pipeline. Hopefully in the next few months, there should be a few more that come out. The academic publishing process is never straightforward, so it can take longer than you would like sometimes. Potentially another book in the pipeline as well. So that's something that we're working on as well. So, yeah, lots going on, lots of stuff, lots of work with different organisations and colleagues around the world in academia, but also within industry as well. So, yeah, lots going on at the moment, but all good.
Well, you're doing magnificent work. Thank you so much.
No worries, Patrick. Thank you very much.